Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So the numbers are out. In Illinois, after the 1970 decennial census, Illinois had 24 congressional seats, 24 members of Congress constitute the Illinois delegation. After the 2020 decennial census, now complete, 17 congressional seats, with Illinois losing another congressional seat after this recently completed census. So you've seen from 70 to 20, 1970 to 2020, 30% loss of congressional seats in Illinois and comparative population by extension during the reign of one Mike Madigan. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Anybody surprised? Excuse me. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I love the way this was being reported on the Illinois site. As expected, Illinois to lose a congressional seat. But some doom and gloomers were projecting that Illinois could lose two congressional seats. So there's nothing to see here. We just lost a congressional seat.
Well, politicians brought it on themselves. I mean, look what they did. High taxes driving people out of here. Mike Madigan in. People like Governor Pritzker. Oh, you know, you're right, Dan. That tone of we thought we were going to lose two, but we lost one. So, you know, winner, winner, chicken dinner.
I'm concerned about it. I will say that, you know, over a decade, we've lost population. Yeah. We've got to turn that around.
It's not over a decade. That's a lie. And it predates Governor Jelly Belly. It just continues with him. It's not over a decade. I assume nobody corrected the record.
No, I wasn't there. It's
over the last 50 years. It's been a steady decline that has increased in pace over the last decade. That's different than saying, oh, this is a recent problem. It's to some extent, it is the fault of Republicans and Democrats alone, but he's trying to middle the issue. Yeah, we had a Republican governor. We have Democrat governor. Mm-hmm. This is very much the reaction from the media, government, political ruling class, press combine in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Very much like Steve Brown, Mike Madigan's spokesman, once explained to me during a conversation we had about the population, the depopulation of Illinois, the exodus not seen since the Israelites fled Egypt. He said, well, I look down Michigan. This is pre-pandemic.
Okay.
I look down Michigan Avenue and I see a hustle and bustle, people going to stores, going to work. And so here's the deal. It's not as bad as you think. There's plenty of blame to go around, and we're working on it.
The old "we're working on it."
That is the three-pronged response. Not as bad as you think. Mm-hmm. Plenty of blame to go around. That's the Pritzker response that you just heard. And, hey, you know, we're working on it. You give us some time.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're in the know, so who's going to lose their congressional seat? Because everybody, you know, mainstream media here, oh, it's going to be a Republican.
Well,
because they'll redistrict and, you know.
Well, yeah, that's what's going to happen more than likely. Since the Democrats control the map, they would they'll do things like make Lauren Underwood's district a little bit more Democrat. And they'll probably most likely throw in Mary Miller, the recently elected congresswoman from Southern Illinois who replaced John Shimkus. Probably her seat gets carved up, you know, because it's a Southern Illinois. It's more sparsely populated, great expanses of land, as opposed to the more dense northeastern Illinois section of the state. So it'll probably be Mary Miller. I mean, they could carve up Kinzinger's district. More likely, Mary Miller. New York, California, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia each lose one seat.
And the winner, Montana, I can understand. North Carolina, Colorado, Texas, Florida, But Oregon? I thought people were moving out of Oregon, but they gained a congressional seat.
In Texas, the big winner with two more congressional seats. So what you see there, generally speaking, is a migration from blue states to red states. So in point of fact, these numbers portend well for House Republicans. They're probably going to pick up a few seats just in the basis of the redistribution of where congressional seats lie in this country. So that will aid and abet Kevin McCarthy's efforts there. Brian in Oak Forest, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I think you talked about it yesterday, but I missed it. I was just, and then the other HB 2789, and then HB 7. I'm interested to know your just your opinion on both.
That's all I got. Wait, 2789? Brian.
Yeah.
Brian, are you
there? With us.
So tell us what those bills are. Tell our audience.
The 2789, it sounded like, I heard it from my cousin yesterday, and she said you mentioned it yesterday. It sounded like something to do with the school, the government getting involved with private schools.
Right. Yep.
And then HB 7 was something my local school district just opposed. And it sounded like they were going to just try to remap all the school districts and cut them back by 25%.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Well, 2789 is, you know, post-pandemic planning for the next pandemic. And that is IDPH promulgates rules and metrics that govern all schools in the state and makes decisions on whether you can have in-class instruction, remote learning, or hybrid based on the metrics that they set forth. So it essentially strips local school districts or private schools of decision-making authority on that
matter. Dr. Nzike will be in charge. And private, Catholic, you know, whatever, religious schools, private schools, and public schools.
Yeah. So, you know, basically for most schools like it is now, where we just pretend there's local control, but all your local officials are doing is parroting whatever they hear from the state commissars.
Exactly.
There are some exceptions, and so those exceptions are important. But, I mean, generally speaking, it's sort of an indictment of K through 12 education in Illinois as if there was another indictment required. Also, California, just going back to the census thing for a moment.
Please.
California, the first time they have lost a congressional seat in that state's history.
Really?
So, you know, even as beautiful as much of California is, not enough to keep enough residents there relative to where they're migrating. I mean, we know the migratory patterns. We've talked about them for years and years and years. So, yes, it's no surprise, but now you're actually seeing the consequences. This is important because we talk about things and say, oh, well, it hasn't happened yet. And rather than taking preventative evasive action, you say, it hasn't happened yet. I'll believe it when it happens. Okay, well, now it's happened. So think about that in the same context when we talk about pension funds that will cap, public sector pension funds that will capsize in the not too distant future, put off by perhaps a year or two now because of the funny money from the feds. So just remember this. So when we have the conversation about, oh, well, you know, I didn't want to, whatever, I don't believe it. They'll figure something out. You know, they always do. They'll always figure something out.
They'll sit the selection out.
And they'll put some masking tape on it, you know, shoestring, staple gun, and they'll figure it out. They'll find some way to stitch this thing together and keep it rolling on. And then they don't. And then you lose a congressional seat. Okay. So just think about that in the context of all the other they'll figure it out. We can just continue pushing off these problems onto the next political hack. And that's what we'll continue to do is follow one political hack after another. Same people, same attitude. Republicans afraid of their shadows and rapacious Democrats that are afraid of, you know, nothing but spending restraint. Now you have one less congressman. Now you've lost almost a third of your congressman in the last 50 years. And Illinois is a garbage state that people are fleeing like a sinking ship. Okay. Mike in Union.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys heard, but, you know, the real problem is that colleges like the University of Alabama offering more math scholarships, according to Governor J.B. Pritzker. And that's why the population's going down, Dan. Don't you know that? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know.
That's right. Thanks for the call. I have actually heard that. The SEC is recruiting our kids, and they're offering them all kinds of cash and prizes to go to Georgia or Alabama. So why isn't U of I doing that? They're the land-grant university here. Instead, they're taking full freight from Chinese nationals and pushing kids with a 35 on their ACT out to the waiting list.
Yep. they're testing kids three times a week, mandatory testing 3 times a week, and still locking them in their dorms.
Well, for COVID, all the colleges are doing that.
No, they're not.
A lot of them are. I mean, you have to be vaccinated to go to Rutgers.
Big Ten schools are, yeah. But I'm saying the SEC, no, you have freedoms there.
I just love these excuses. These excuses they come up with. Just wave off. It's not as bad as you think. Oh, it's the SEC pilfering our best and brightest and so on and so forth. Illinois has been 49th in the nation in the retention of college-bound high school seniors for a decade. And so, again, to revisit conversations we've had before with data we've presented previously, what happens when kids go away to college?
They don't come back.
And especially are they coming back to what Chicago and Illinois look like today and with their respective job opportunities and their chosen fields as compared to other states? And of course not. You know, success builds on itself, Texas, Florida. So does failure, Illinois, Michigan,
Ohio,
Connecticut, New York, California.
Oh, who's going to lose their congressional seat in New York? Could it be AOC?
No. That would be a real treat if it was AOC in New York and Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, wouldn't it?
That would be quite something.
The Congress wouldn't be the same if two of the four socialist Spice Girls were gone. And I'm not even including Eric Swalwell. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
This letter, I can't do Casey Kasem, otherwise I can't even do Dana Carvey doing Casey Kasem, but let's go to the mailbag.
Oh, okay.
Dion Joseph is a 24-year veteran of the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department. Dear LeBron, he writes.
Oh, do we need music for this one?
No, it's not particularly poignant. Okay. He starts out by saying, you know, he's a fan of the Lakers. He likes him. He's got no name call. There's going to be no name calling here. But he goes on to point out, your tweet that targeted a police officer in Ohio who saved a young woman's life was irresponsible and disturbing. Showed a complete lack of understanding of the challenge of our job in the heat of the moment. You basically put a target on the back of a human being who had to make a split-second decision to save a life from a deadly attack, talking about LeBron's tweet, of course. A decision I know he and many others wish they never had to make, especially when it involves someone so young. Instead of apologizing for the tweet, you deflected. You said you took your tweet down because you did not want it to be used for hate, when the tweet itself was the embodiment of hatred, rooted in a lack of understanding of the danger of the situation. I don't know if I'll ever reach you, but my hope is that one day I can sit down with you and talk. He goes on to say the offer is on the table. No cameras, no fanfare, beer summit sort of thing. Just two men who care talking. I know it's a long shot, but this division and hatred must stop. It's clear based on rising crime in marginalized communities that cops and the community need to build bridges to save lives on all sides. This cannot be done through the demonization of any group of people. Well, Dion, this Whitney Houston classic, Greatest Love of All, goes out to you, and hoping that you and LeBron get that beer summit. No, it's fair. No, I like the approach by this cop. He's trying to do something constructive while, you know, maintaining moral rectitude on the matter of policing and not mincing words when it came to LeBron's reaction to it, knowing the influence LeBron has.
Because the race baiters all didn't run over there and start clearing, you know, get this police officer arrested. He should be charged. And No, because it was he did the right thing.
Well, they did initially. They did initially because Benjamin Crump, the civil rights attorney, he was there. He was on site.
He's in North Carolina last night.
Yeah, he was on site. We mentioned it, and he said, "Shot an innocent girl." That's what he said. Shot and killed an innocent girl. 24 hours after the Chauvin verdict, or same day, I can't remember now. A North Carolina police officer shot an innocent girl. That's what he said. Now, because there is substantial pushback to that effort, now they've moved on to Andrew Brown in North Carolina.
Okay.
Val Demings is a Democrat member of the U.S. House from Florida. She is a former Orlando, Florida police chief. She was on Face the Nation, CBS's talk show, on Sunday. She had this to say about that Columbus, Ohio shooting.
Well, you know, John, when I served as a police chief, what I prayed for daily was that my police officers would respond as they are trained to do. Now, after every incident, we would have to go back and look at our policies and make sure that the policies met the moment. But look, I worked as a social worker with foster care children. So it's a sad moment for me. But I also was a patrol officer who was out there on the street having to make those split-second decisions. You know, now everybody has the benefit of slowing the video down and seizing the perfect moment. The officer on the street does not have that ability. He or she has to make those split-second decisions, and they're tough. But the limited information that I know in viewing the video, it appears that the officer responded as he was trained to do, with the main thought of preventing a tragedy and a loss of life of the person who was about to be assaulted.
All right. It's interesting. Interesting to get the perspective of somebody who was a police officer and police chief, but is a black Democrat member of the House. That was her view on what happened in Columbus, Ohio. And it seems to me that the effort to fold that case into George Floyd and Breonna Taylor seems to me that's waning. And as I said, they're turning their attention to Andrew Brown now with the demands for the body cam footage of the shooting and killing in Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
But the problem, to be released,
which will probably happen next week.
Yeah, they showed the family 20 seconds of it yesterday, and that wasn't enough. Ben Crump was down there, too, yesterday. Bringing the pulpit about that. And, yeah, we'll pass judgment on when we see the video. But 7 sheriff's deputies have been put on administrative leave. But back to the Columbus, Ohio. So many people, Dan, kept saying, well, you know, you can get stabbed, but you can't get killed. That's not true. Over the weekend, a Good Samaritan was stabbed to death trying to stop an attack at a Berwyn grocery store. This guy thought this teenage girl was cutting in line, so he started beating her up. Then he started beating up her mom, who was a cashier. And this great guy, Umberto Guzman, 32 years old, just had a baby, tried to break up the fight, and he got stabbed to death. It took 2 stabs, boom, boom, and he was dead. So all these people keep saying, oh, no, he should have used his taser. No, in a split second, Umberto Guzman was dead, and his wife is without a husband, and a baby is without her father. And it's sickening. And so that was just a graphic reminder. Stabbings, people die, okay? People wake up.
Yeah. I suppose you know the depth of desperation when someone is arguing that knives don't kill people or somebody with a knife can't kill somebody. Somebody can't be stabbed to death. What are you talking about? This whole, like, knife play is kids horsing around.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absurd. It doesn't even need a discussion on the merits.
I know.
It's laughable. It's pathetic.
Or he should have used his taser.
There was a French police officer that was stabbed to death over the weekend, and the assailant, who I believe yelled Allahu Akbar when stabbing the French police officer to death, was shot and killed to stop his rampage. I mean, this is not really up for discussion among sapient beings, but I understand that there are many non-sentient, non-sapient beings in public office, so we have to address these silly arguments. Oh, speaking of which, on the topic of law enforcement and maintaining peace on the streets. This big news out of Chicago. City sues Indiana gun store, claiming it's helping fuel gun violence in Chicago by selling to straw purchasers. Oh, it's nice.
That's
it's nice that you can, you know, reminds me of the line from Hoosiers. It's nice. You know, some things never change. Life never changes there in small town Indiana. It gives you a real solid feeling. That's how I feel about Chicago. It's nice that things never change here. When you're presiding over the turning over the city to mobsters, to street gangs, when you're turning out violent criminals again and again and again through the Cook County Prosecutor's Office, it's nice that we fall back to our customary misdirection plays. Hey, you know what we need to do? Let's go file a civil lawsuit against a gun owner in Indiana, a gun shop in Indiana, so that we can continue our narrative about these guns flowing in from Indiana. That's the only problem Chicago has.
Yeah, it's called West 4th Sports. It's 10 miles from the city's border. They said that they've knowingly been selling guns to traffickers and straw buyers who transports guns to Chicago.
Yeah, that's
to the tune
ATF's
of 850
for.
Gun crimes.
That's what the ATF's for. End of discussion. A civil suit from the city of Chicago? Who cares?
Yeah.
It's a complete misdirection play, as always.
They can claim whatever they want in a lawsuit.
If the federal firearm license holder there in Gary, Indiana, is violating the law, then he should be prosecuted. End of story. Can we get back to what you aren't doing or are doing, Fox, Lightfoot, at all?
That Tucker Carlson bit that you played yesterday, and I watched it in its entirety yesterday, who in God's name would move to Chicago after seeing that? That was an excellent piece and a real-life version of the hell that we're living in.
The only thing that we're missing here with this ham-handed misdirection play by Triple Threat is Father Flager, because he's been sidelined. We just need Father Flager with a bullhorn outside this gun shop in Gary, Indiana, and then we'll have the scene. And cut, print, send it to Chicago Press Corps to cut and paste. What a joke.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Oh, and by the way, speaking of the press corps, I noted a second person of interest, Mike Scott reporting it, is being detained in connection with the Jaslyn Adams killing, mm-hmm. the 7-year-old girl. Anybody ask any questions about dad yet? Anybody ask any questions about him?
His dad figured this out, why his daughter was killed?
Well, how about, does he know the two guys in custody? The press showed up so that he could, you know, heap moral scorn on those who opened fire on his car and killed his daughter. What do we know about what he knows? Do the microphones only work when it comes to sort of the pro forma presentation of the grieving father? What about the father who may have been a gangbanger? Police said he was.
Yeah.
What about the father whose Facebook pictures I've seen are all gangster crap, including his little daughter in the pictures.
Yeah.
Giving, the picture is him and her, like as a toddler, giving the finger to who's ever taking the picture.
Yeah, it's real nice.
Isn't that delightful?
Yeah, sweet. Christmas card photo stuff.
Nobody ask?
No.
Nobody? No. Javonte Adams, is he unreachable at this point? Nick in Des Moines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey there. So there's a new series out from PBS on Larry Krasner, which I find kind of interesting. I watched the first two episodes of it because he's going to have his primary coming up here in May. So we'll see what colorful light they like to portray the progressive DA in Philly. Mm-hmm. But it'll be really telling to see if the voters in Philly are less progressive than they are in Chicago, because obviously we got Kim Fox round two.
Did Kim Fox make it to the Oscars on Sunday night? I know she hangs with the Hollywood set. Was she there?
She could have been in the back room.
Yeah. Sorry, Nick.
Yeah, she could have gotten that ticket from Juicy Smollett, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you as well, what's going on with Lori Lightfoot, because she's not progressive enough for the mob, because they show up at her house and protest all the time. Mm-hmm. The police, she's completely alienated. and the teachers union walks all over her, and she's not really quite like corrupt enough, I think, to like operate in the city in the typical machine politics.
Yeah.
So is she just like, you know, getting, does she have any future, or do all these parties think it's great because they can just hip toss her around like a rag doll? I think they probably think it's great because they can just push her around and she can, you know, play her game of, you know, Joe Pesci or whatever and speak loudly and carry a tiny little stick.
That's a great question. Analysis, yeah. Nick. That's a great analysis. I think you're on to it. Lori Lightfoot is a woman without a constituency, which probably ensures that she'll be there forever.
She's a woman without a country.
Because she doesn't interfere. She's not really interfering with anything. Right. This is what confused John Cass, with all due respect to my good friend John Cass, who I love and who's a brilliant guy. You know, for the first time in a long time, you saw somebody who wasn't on the make. You know, Lori Lightfoot, there's some potential there because she's not trying to personally enrich herself through the mayor's office. And I think that's probably true. She doesn't have any friends. She has no friends to give contracts and wire things up for. She's not that person.
No, she did give a contract to the Chromebooks that were an absolute failure to a guy who donated $36,000 to her campaign.
Yeah. But
that was one corrupt thing that that's questionable.
That's not necessarily corrupt.
A six-figure contract.
So what? I mean, if
the books didn't work.
Well, okay, but I mean, you have to dig deeper. I mean, that's not enough.
Okay,
and that's not the culture that Lori Lightfoot has. She keeps her own counsel. She is, you know, an army of one. She's always the smartest person in the room. She doesn't really like people. She plays identitarian politics, but she's really not, you know, a full-blown identitarian. Or she sure wasn't when she was at Mayor Brown. She sure wasn't when she was in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Now all of a sudden she wears the jacket because that's what's politically advantageous, you see. So I think that's right. I think and Jelly Belly's kind of the same way. They're both sort of two sides of the same coin, which is they want to wear the sash. They want to be popular. Lori Lightfoot actually did some things in her career, you know, obviously, Spalding is just a kid who never did anything, never is did looking anything. For meaning in his life. And so having that title on his epitaph now has imbued his life with meaning. And I think for Lori Lightfoot, she was, you know, probably somebody that was ridiculed as a kid and probably that was never part of the in crowd. And now she's, you know, on the top of the hill and she's going to enjoy it. That's why she likes going on Oprah. That's why she likes going on CNN, is because people are actually paying attention to her now because they have to, because of the power that office wields. So she gets to walk around with the sash, and she gets, just like a Jelly Belly does, and they get to pretend they're in charge.
The big SUVs with, you know, security detail. It's fun.
Yeah, the phalanx, all the trappings of power in the office, absolutely.
Drivers,
you know, they get to, as Nick was saying perfectly, they get to talk the big game. But they're really interested in popularity, so they're not going to ruffle any feathers. I mean, you know, she may tell some alderman to go blank himself, but that's only when he comes at her. That's not a policy change. That's not a paradigm shift in Chicago, you see. So, yeah, I think that's right. I think that Jelly Belly and Triple Threat have bright political futures in Chicago, in Illinois and Chicago, respectively, because of that. They're not in the way. They're little speed bumps to work around. Pat them on the head, compliment them, support them for reelection. In JB's case, take his money with a big thank you and fed him at these you know, funders around the state. That's all you have to do. He stays there as sort of a vestigial office holder, same with Lori Lightfoot. And then everybody gets to do what they want. The kleptocrats do what they want. And then this, you know, yeah, obviously it's violent in the city and the city runs wild. But that doesn't really bother beneficiaries of transfer payments who just continue to vote in whoever they're given to vote for on the Democrat side, and the champagne socialists on the lakefront and the North Shore in the western suburbs who could give a rat's ass because, one, many of them don't live in the city. Two, they don't really care about the city. Those people, and that's how they refer to them at cocktail parties when they're out of earshot of the media or the actual office holders, yep, by the way. And so everything's fine. They're insulated from terrible public policy. They're insulated from shooting galleries on the west side and the south side. They don't care. That's how it works. Welcome to a Central American benevolent dictatorship, endorsed by the majority of the people. Tony and Roselle.
Well, I wanted to point out, we drifted a bit, but people have been killing each other with edged weapons for thousands of years, much longer than firearms. And I want to touch on the gun shop. If Chicago's so sure that this gun shop is selling to straw purchasers, surely there's a list of select individuals through which a large number of guns have passed legally through background checks and ended up on the street. They've got to have an idea who these straw purchasers are if there's so many straw purchasers. Why aren't
go after
they
the straw
looking
purchasers,
at that?
Right.
Well,
it's not their job. It's not Chicago's job. Chicago doesn't have jurisdiction over Gary.
Right.
It's state police, Gary police, ATF. I mean, that's what I'm saying. This is just, honestly, same thing over and over again. Rinse and repeat. Why not? It always works. It always works to draw people's attention away. Have a press conference. Call a few Southside reverends if Flager's not available. Decry guns violence. Meanwhile, per that Tucker Carlson piece you mentioned that we played yesterday, meanwhile, one of the killers of Darian Albert, who could be in jail for 30 years like his co-murderers, gets a walk on a gun charge from Kim Fox.
Yeah.
But you're serious about interdicting gun crime, right? And so it goes. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oak Park River Forest High School.
OPRF, the Huskies.
Yeah.
What are they up to now, those crazy kids?
It's a real crown jewel of West Central Cook County, right?
Used to be a powerhouse.
Yeah, used to be a lot of things. It's not anymore. Did you happen to catch any of that docu-series they did on that high school? I can't even remember what channel it was on. I watched a couple episodes. That place is a catastrophe. An absolute catastrophe. I mean, you want to see unintentionally. Because this, I think it was produced by one of the guys from Hoop Dreams. You want to see a school that is not even a thinly veiled indoctrination camp. That's what it is. All you have to do is listen to the administrators and teachers and school board members profiled there. Remarkable. Remember, this is the school that was at the tip of the spear when it came to doing race-based assemblies. Only black students may attend.
Yep.
That's where you want to go? I'm sorry, that was the promise of Brown v. Board of Education? I'm confused. That's what Thurgood Marshall argued? Is that what he argued for?
The series was called America to Me, by the way.
It's an absolute disgrace. That was supposed to profile the school. I came away based on seeing it, even more skeptical than I was just sort of knowing about it anecdotally and looking at the declining academic performance and knowing who's in charge there. Knowing who's in charge there, fiduciaries like Gina Harris and Ralph Martiri. Gina Harris and Ralph Martiri are school board members at OPRF. They're also professors, and I use that term in quotation marks to denote the indoctrination and the quality of their scholarship, at Roosevelt University. And I use university in quotation marks with respect to Roosevelt. Because it is not an institution of higher learning. Sorry. It's time to start calling things how they are today, not how they were once upon a time, like what OPRF was once upon a time versus what it is today. Scales from eyes, folks. Ralph Martiri is also the director, Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. This is this I mean, he's a leftist masquerading as some sort of economist. He and I debated the flat tax at the Union League Club. I mean, the, you know, changing the flat tax to graduated state income tax a couple of years ago in advance of the ballot question last November. So I'll, if you want to watch that debate between the two of us, I mean, it was, I got to present, then he got to present. We went back and forth a little bit. It was fun. It was good. Good conversation of sorts. Martiri, though, is one of these guys who believes that every dollar of government spending has a positive multiplier effect. Literally. And so it prompts the question, well, if that's true, then why don't you just support the government confiscating all of our money because they're going to spend it more wisely than we do to greater ends for us? And that's essentially what he believes, but you can't take his position to the its logical conclusion because, of course, nobody would support such an absurdity. But that's essentially Martiri's disposition. Well, here's Martiri and Gina Harris going back and forth about Roosevelt and OPRF and their living out their Marxist fantasies in both places in advance of a Zoom call recently.
Hey, Gina, you teaching at Roosevelt this semester?
Yes, Ralph, I am.
Great. What are you teaching?
Mm-hmm. I'm teaching middle school theory and practice, basically.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's quite wonderful.
I love the university. I just do.
I have to say, I do too.
Yeah, it's a great place. I'm so glad you're there too. You fit in so well with their, you know, the university's philosophy and mission, right?
I mean, it's all social justice all day, every day. I get to talk about all the things I love all the time.
All day, every day.
All day in the day gig, all night in my night classes, when I'm here. Like, I mean, really, I'm living the life over here.
Yeah, I always flip out the kids that take my master's class on fiscal policy and public budgets when the first three or four classes are devoted to philosophy of social justice and how you organize society. We don't talk about one, you know, budgetary item. They're like, oh, man, Professor Martiri, this is a really weird way to teach a budget.
You know, it's part of everything, right? What a foundation.
If you don't understand your values, you can't allocate resources among public priorities that are scarce but all needed, right?
Right. Right? Wow. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Boy, that master's in finance from Roosevelt University looks impressive. First, you learn to be a central planner and a reallocator philosophically. Then we get to the numbers. Yeah. Right. And that's fine. I mean, it's fine. I mean, I had to, as an undergrad, I had one of the great Keynesian economists in the country as an instructor and somebody I talked to semi-frequently, Bob Eisner. He's a great economist. Disagreed with him. But that's not what's happening here. No, that's not me and Bob Eisner going back and forth about Friedman versus Keynes or what have you. That doesn't exist anymore. What exists is maleducated children from K through 12 that go to pretend universities to get further indoctrinated into activism by hacks like Ralph Martiri and Gina Harris. So anybody want to defend OPRF and the schools in your area that are doing the same thing OPRF is doing, but perhaps maybe just a little bit less out and proud about it? Where's the opposition to any of this? Is there any? Is there any in your community? Are you part of any opposition? You know, it's funny. I look at this in the context of states that are growing and states that are shrinking. In other words, states that are living and states that are dying. And I know North Carolina gained a congressional seat.
Right.
And North Carolina is, you know, it's close. Obviously, you've had a Republican governor recently, now a Democrat governor. North Carolina went for Biden, right? But I note the North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who we've spoken about before, including yesterday, he is heading up a commission to take on indoctrination. There's a task force there 12-person advisory board for FACS, teachers, administrators, university professors, community members, and they're taking on the sort of indoctrination that we talk about routinely in K through 12 education. Is anybody doing that here rather than our program? Anybody? No? And this is in addition to Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson taking on ballot integrity issues. This is in addition to Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson defending people's Second Amendment rights at the local, as now at the state level. We have any Mark Robinsons in this state? Do we? I mean, other than that eighth grader in the Naperville School District who took on the school board, or the girl from Vandalia High School who took on the mask mandate down there?
No mask Mondays.
Do we have any adults here, I should say? I think we have some kids. I'm not sure we have any adults here in the mold of Mark Robinson, the lieutenant governor of North Carolina. And so when you listen to what's happening at OPRF and put that in the context of why this place is withering on the vine, as compared to other states that are doing things very differently. Ron DeSantis in Florida, executive order banning critical race theory instruction, indoctrination, really, in schools. You want to talk about different schools of thought? Fine. I mean, I read the Marx Engels Reader in high school and then again in college, too. I'm not afraid of ideas with which I disagree. I'm not afraid. Mao's Little Red Book. Let's have it out. But they're not instructional manuals. It's part of examining scholarship from across a spectrum. That's different. So don't, you know, I don't want to hear this. You just want to put, you know, it's just all Austrian economics and the University of Chicago school, and you want to ban everything. No. I'm not banning anything. No. Conservatives aren't in the business of banning anything. Come what may, bring your best ideas. Bring your worst ideas. Let's hash them all out. It's the left that is turn these schools into indoctrination camps, re-education centers. That's what they are. And again, the opposition, I know we had some school board candidates that we profiled on this show and tried to get people engaged with the school board elections this past April, but
one. No, I think there's two.
I mean, where is community level leadership? And I'm not even talking about politicians or party, just community level leadership on any of this stuff. I mean, this is absolute decimation of future generations. Everybody's doing everything for the kids, I'm told.
Right. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know what? I was going through my DePaul and Dominion because I used to donate in the past because I kind of like those institutions, Dominion College and River Forest. So I get their magazine. And as I'm cutting out pictures for target practice, if you have a pellet gun, those pictures are beautiful to shoot at. All the degrees are what they talk about, in the, not about accounting, not about finance, not about, you know, curing diseases. It's all activism and social justice and BLM and getting the vote and all of this kind of crap. Nothing that would actually help us in the future of winning, let's say, a war. Like, if you were taught this curriculum back when we had World War II, do you think we would have won? I don't think so. I don't think we'd build a transcontinental railroad today. In other words, what I'm trying to say is these degrees are absolutely worthless. They're destroying companies, but yet this is the jobs of the future. DePaul, Dominion, this is all you're going to have. Roosevelt, I'm sure that's all you're going to have is activism. And you know what? We haven't hit rock bottom yet. No one has felt the pain of all these social liberal type views. Everyone just goes along, want a car, go buy a car, no problem. So in other words, we haven't hit rock bottom for anything
yet. Thanks for the call, Ed. I agree with that. And there's going to be kids that come through this fine, and they're independent thinkers, and they're talented, successful people. This is not across the board. But that's what people misunderstand. oh, you know, I hear about this. And, you know, it's a small group of people at our school. It doesn't represent the majority view of the parents. It's not really happening to a majority of the kids. You think it requires a majority? What history did you learn? It requires a motivated minority. That's what it's always been in history. It's not, these things are not done by plebiscite. They're done by willpower, one way or the other, good or bad. We used to understand this. A friend recently reminded me of a great talk Bishop Fulton Sheehan gave 50 years ago. Remember Fulton Sheehan? People remember him? I mean, he predates me, but thanks to the EWTN and the interweb, you can go back and watch his speeches. I mean, this was a dominant television figure. There was once in America where NBC gave Bishop Fulton Sheehan an hour program.
Wow.
To educate the populace. And educate he did. 50 years ago, Bishop Fulton Sheehan describing the choice before America. Where is America going to march? Was the title of his speech. I won't bore you with the Latin. Where is America going to march? The two choices. Thomas Jefferson's vision of America. Belief in God and the dignity of man, or in the direction of Saint Just, the angel of death during the French Revolution. So a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson's. We could have gone that way, and Thomas Jefferson didn't want us to go that way, and the founders, those, you know, terrible white men. They didn't want us to go the way of Robespierre and Saint Just. But we could go that way. What is that way?
Those are the two principles. And isn't it interesting that that particular government and those governments in the world that deny the existence of God are those that deny the existence of human rights? Now, let's go to Saint-Just. What is Saint-Just? And along with him, Royer. What was their principle? Their principle was that in order to make people pass through a certain door, there was only one way to do it, and that was the way of terror. Confiscation of property, and the destruction of rights and liberties. Saint-Just also said a people can be taught to save themselves only by violence. And the path to the establishment of every government must be upon a pile of corpses. That was the thing that Jefferson had to fight against when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He knew it. It wasn't anything new. I'm bringing it up now to remind you that we're going through exactly that same crisis now that Jefferson faced. That our country today has to choose once more between Jefferson and Saint-Just. Which are we going to choose?
50 years later, it's the same question. Wow. Bob and Wilmette, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. In response to your, you know, power people challenging the wokeness indoctrination, well, I've got a son graduating from Loyola Academy in Wilmette next month.
Yeah.
And I think, Dan, you've mentioned it too, but some of the major donors they're just fed up and they're pulling out. And unless we see this across the board, you know, this sort of stuff is going to continue. But especially in the private schools. Now, the public schools, like the big new Trier, I don't have an answer for that. But at least with Loyola, There are some major, major donors and minor donors, too, who are fed up with it and pulling out. And as they say, money talks.
Yeah, no, for them. Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that is finally there's a reaction to Loyola Academy. And maybe if you see more than just sort of middling messages from the leadership at the school and you really see change in terms of the curriculum and the approach to education there. And frankly, the faculty, because the faculty has largely been lost to the social justice mob. If you start to see some of those changes, then, yeah, that'll be a model for success where parents turned it around. Absolutely. Diana in Avondale.
Hi, I'm a teacher in Chicago Public Schools, and I apologize to all of Chicagoland about how the union has handled this. You know, basically, I wanted to say that I think that parents need to start looking into taking the children out of CPS and moving them elsewhere, because what's happening is brainwashing, and I won't support it. I won't do it.
Well, what grade do you teach?
Why does Leslie teach primary grades? But there has been teachers in the upper grades that have received information about teaching this critical race theory, which I just think that we're teaching kids to look at each other's skin color, which they weren't doing. They weren't doing that. And that was the whole goal of Martin Luther King Jr., was not to look at each other's skin color and look at each other's character. And this is just so sad what's happening in America. My family is not from here, and we've seen socialism. So people don't realize that socialism isn't what they believe it is. It is a terrible place to live. You want to wait to get milk at 3 in the morning. That's what socialism turns out to be. And people don't realize that. It's just a sad time. I think parents need to start suing the system for teaching racism.
Yeah. And if you look at
Thanks
kids,
for the
I mean,
call, Diana. Appreciate
it. I've got kids on my team. They're all black, white, Hispanic. Nobody treats anybody differently because of the color of their skin. There's no racial discord going on, and they're creating this.
They'll
it's like they're
to.
Recruiting people to become transgender. Maybe you might be gay. Do you want to try it out, son? I mean, it's disgusting what the schools are doing. There is no racial discord, I'm telling you.
Jefferson or San Juste, what is it going to be?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Sometimes it's helpful to get an outsider's perspective, particularly if that outsider has the same ends as you state that you have, in this case, a strong America. James Morrow is a presenter for Sky News in Australia, and here's his commentary on where the Biden administration is leading the nation. This is on the occasion of Anzac Day in Australia, which is our equivalent of Veterans Day.
Today is Anzac Day, when we commemorate all those who made the ultimate sacrifice fighting for our freedoms and fighting very often side by side with soldiers from the United States. Which is why today it is so depressing to look at what is happening to the U.S. under Joe Biden, who seems, for whatever reason, determined to weaken America's standing, her military, and emboldening her and our enemies, making a mockery of a century's worth of shared sacrifice. Now, we've all seen the silly side of Joe Biden's green eco-warrior posturing, which this week included the bizarre spectacle of the U.S. president wearing his face mask on a Zoom call to discuss climate talks as bemused world leaders looked on. But there's a more serious side to this posturing, which recently also involved the U.S. Navy putting a mask on its own Eagle logo. And this is it. The Biden administration's push to go green and force its friends and allies like Australia to do the same, even as China is allowed to keep emitting and growing willy-nilly, is also going to weaken America's ability to project power around the world. And that's bad news for all of us.
It is bad news, James, and that's not the half of it. The administration's eco czar, John Kerry, former Secretary of State.
Oh, yeah. Who's just like us, man, flying commercial.
Except when he flies private to Iceland to get an award for saving the planet.
Unbelievable.
He leaked information to Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, during the Trump administration.
Of course he did.
Leaked information about Israel. According to a New York Times report, leaked audio tapes obtained by the Britain-based Iran International, Zarif told a supporter that the former Secretary of State had informed him about at least 200 covert Israeli actions against Iranian interests in Syria. Zarif characterized as listening to this information in astonishment, an astonishing disclosure from a former Secretary of State of the United States vis-a-vis aiding and abetting the largest state sponsor of terror in the world to the detriment of our essentially one true consistent ally in the Middle East. That's not only violative of the Logan Act, which is something that the Democrats were real interested in when it came to General Michael Flynn, you may recall. It's traitorous. Because compromising Israel and compromising our ability to get reliable intelligence from Israel because they may trust us less with the likes of John Kerry in positions of authority compromises our national security, doesn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
It's a traitor. It's treason. Don't you think? It's a treasonous act.
I mean,
what he did, he doesn't have America's best interest at heart. He has his Democratic parties and his own best interest.
I'm sure he would say in defense that this was, you know, in trying to maintain a relationship with the mullahs so that we could prevent them from going nuclear as per the deal negotiated in the Obama administration.
It's not his business. He should butt out.
Well, if not butt out, then at least don't disclose intelligence as it pertains to the Israelis. I mean, is that not obvious? David Harsanyi, writing a national review on this. I mean, just let this seep in for a minute. A high-ranking American official feels comfortable sharing this information with an autocratic adversary, a government that's murdered hundreds of Americans, regularly kidnapped them, interfered with our elections, propped up a regime that gasses its people, the Syrians, about the covert actions of a longtime American ally. And it also raises the question, what else did he tell Zarif? Maybe it's a question he should answer, or the Biden administration should.
The congressional hearing.
New York Times reported on this, but of course they buried the lead towards the end of the article, but thankfully it was picked up by Harsanyi, our friend Ed Morrissey over at Hot Air. And why wouldn't the Israelis, why wouldn't Bibi at this point be more reluctant to share intel with the United States when Kerry is the go-to guy for saving the planet? And the Biden administration, you know, is looking to reopen negotiations with Iran. Boy, if I was Israel, I'd feel a little jumpy about this administration, wouldn't you? If I was in the U.S. military, particularly military intelligence, the State Department, I'd feel a little jumpy about this information.
His role now? He's a climate czar?
Yeah. Jetting around, you know, extracting nothing from China, but pretending to.
Mm-hmm. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Interesting.
We also have, I mean, as Harsanyi points out, it's worth remembering that others, like Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, Democrat Socialist, secretly met with Zarif in Munich in a coordinated effort to undercut the Trump administration's efforts to derail Iran's ongoing nuclear weapons program. I mean, these stories were that story. John Kerry's meddling was, of course, wildly underreported during the Trump administration, and it continues to be during the Biden administration. But this time, it's a little bit more serious than just having a chat with an old friend, when there is evidence of that sort of intelligence disclosure to the largest state sponsor of terror in the world. Does that bother anybody? Is that prompt any questioning from members of the D.C. press corps? No, probably not. Jerry in Mundelein, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. This guy, John Kerry, who served in Vietnam, you know, he's been a stain on our country since he got out of Vietnam when he lied about throwing his medals over the fence and all that other crap. Mm-hmm. This guy should be arrested for treason, plain and simple. He is nothing but, like I said, he's a stain on this country. This guy, he flies around with his private jets telling all this cock and bull stuff that he takes commercial flights and all this other stuff. He is so full of it. He should be arrested for treason, plain and simple. And where are the Republicans complaining to the media, to anybody that'll listen about this guy? How come he's not under investigation? He's been doing this. He undermined the Trump administration, and nobody did a thing about it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Jerry. Hey, what's Bob Mueller doing? Can we reassemble the team?
Yeah.
Merrick Garland, how about a special prosecutor? How about an investigation here? I mean, I know he's sort of this ad hoc official without an agency, just with a private plane. I mean, this stuff, it's just amazing. This gives you.
It should give everybody great pause.
Right. I mean, and instead what it does is further drive cynicism about the government. You think that's helpful? I understand that Zarif also did the old, hey, John, why the long face?
Oh,
so, when they met because they're friends.
Yes.
And that's just my face. Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, check out the news article from Reuters back in, I believe, October. Look up metric tons of wheat. They basically gave it to the Iranian government. There was a blight in Russia, and then that drove all our prices up in this country. It was okay to make our prices go sky high and create a wheat shortage over here, so we could get charged more, but they helped them out. They would have starved.
Thanks, Chuck. Bob in Milwaukee.
Perhaps the Republicans won't, as usual, do anything about it, but maybe Mossad will at least take a look at this.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. I mean, look, the Israelis, I mean, you're not going to have Bibi come out and confirm that's true, obviously. They're not going to further compromise their intelligence. Right. There's going to be the incentive to just sort of walk past it. But you know, if the New York Times is reporting it, that's a statement against interests if we were in a court of law. So pretty credible. And it certainly demands John Kerry be asked about it by the press corps. You know, our press corps, not the Israeli press corps. Be nice if our press corps got on the stick for just a second. I mean, I guess
they're going to never discuss this story.
Well, maybe Peter Ducey will ask the question of Jen Psaki. That's probably as close as we're going to get. Chip in St. Charles.
Hey, Dan and Amy, the identitarians on the left, they hate the Jews, but they sure like to call the rest of us racist. And the second thing is John Kerry has absolutely nothing to worry about because we have a two-tiered justice system in this country, and he knows no matter what he does, he's walking free.
Thanks, Chip. Well, to my point about driving the cynicism, I mean, it's hard not to be cynical when you see how people behave, and what Chip describes is what we've seen over the last 3 years at the federal level, isn't it? Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, this is not surprising. Another Northeast Democrat like Senator Kennedy when he went behind the back of the Reagan administration to the Russians. I mean, that same type of philosophy is what we see here, maybe on a bigger level, a more serious level. But it's that same type of philosophy. Same type of philosophy in Chicago. Keep voting in Kim Fox. Keep voting in for the same. Everybody knew that she was a George Soros-backed candidate. Anybody that had a brain. I mean, so this is what America apparently wants to do. This is John Kerry is right in the footsteps of his mentor, Senator Kennedy. Same kind of thing.
Same kind of state. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Marvin. And maybe this is what Biden meant with his unity message. It wasn't unity with the opposition party here. It was unity with the mullahs in Tehran. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the CDC is set to promulgate new guidelines with respect to mask wearing outdoors.
Yeah, and the message is going to come from President Biden later today. And there's going to be new rules, Dan, for those who are vaccinated and those who are not vaccinated.
Yeah.
When it comes to wearing your little masky outdoors.
And that's if we can make out what Biden's saying behind his mask. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who was FDA commissioner for the Trump administration for a time. Frankly, there's few people outside of Fauci who've been more unnerving during this than Scott Gottlieb, to me.
Okay.
Because he knows better, I would think. And, you know, he's a medical doctor. I'm not. I can see the point, but there's also what we've actually experienced. And so his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal is really something. Once you've lost Scott Gottlieb when it comes to these COVID-19 restrictions, you're in trouble. He writes, as conditions improve, policymakers must show they're willing to ease restrictions as swiftly as they impose them. A critical early test will be on mask wearing outside. Wearing masks and restricting large gatherings were essential to controlling the pandemic's worst peaks, but the infection levels are dropping and vaccination rates rising. This is the time to revisit rules on masking and distancing in low-risk outdoor activities like parks and sports venues. Easing these rules would move more activity outdoors, which reduces viral transmission. Gosh, that's funny. That sounds like something we were saying last summer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Gottlieb goes on to document studies that have shown virtually no incidence of transmission outdoors. That's funny. That sounds like something we were saying last summer. So now we have Scott Gottlieb on board, however incrementally. By the way, Gottlieb is a board member at Pfizer.
You know, right. Keep that in mind. That, former that is, FDA commissioner, in case you don't remember.
That is something to, yes, the board member at Pfizer is something to, you know, factor
keep an
in.
Eye on. Yeah.
But you know, even Scott Gottlieb is moving towards something commonsensical. Maybe he'll share that in his regular appearances on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan.
Oh, and he did.
I think there shouldn't be requirements that they have to wear masks outdoors. I think we should also be thinking about how to rapidly lift requirements and mandates on gatherings outside.
Yeah, great. But you know, listen, but Charlie Wojciechowski from NBC was interviewing Chicagoans who were walking around with masks on. Like, you know, how long are you going to keep this going? And some people, I just think there's a lot of uninformed Chicagoans out there. Here's an elderly gentleman, George.
I just don't know where we are. It's very confusing. So I just decided I'll just wear my mask until maybe the end of the summer, and then I'll see.
And this guy, he's going to wear his mask for the foreseeable future.
I'm hoping we get to a point in the near future, over the next few months to a year, to where we'll be able to live back normal again.
At least the first guy concedes that he's uninformed, and yeah, he just wants to feel. Everybody just wants to feel, so they don't have to think. For more on the topic, oh, and by the way, Michigan, which is now seeing, even though they had the spike in cases, now seeing a reduction in cases as well. Good. In response to that reduction in cases, they're moving their mask mandate down from 5 years old and up to 2 years old and up.
2 years old. Oh, my God. They could choke on that thing.
In the infinite wisdom of the Eva Peron of East Lansing. We're now pleased to be joined by Dr. Roger Klein again. He's an expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. He's a former advisor there because that was back in a day when, I guess, common sense was welcome in addition to medical expertise. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
You can sense at least my frustration, even with people I'm otherwise inclined to respect, like Dr. Scott Gottlieb. Your perspective on even the recalcitrant like Dr. Gottlieb coming along on this?
I mean, so think about this. Last week, the CDC announced that among vaccinated people, among 84 million vaccinated people, there were 74 deaths associated with COVID. That number is roughly equivalent to having 6 cases of blood clots in association with 6.8 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It is about the same as getting struck by lightning. So your chance, if you're fully vaccinated, of dying from COVID are about the same as getting struck by lightning.
Well, and no matter the age group, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if you're 90 and double vaccinated or 50.
Presumably, those 74 had some type of frailty and were elderly. So, yeah, I mean,
But old people die.
You know, the odds go up of dying of anything when you get, when you're in an elderly age group and you're not well.
And so for people, again, this conversation we've been having since the summer, it's nice that some people are finally coming along almost a year later. But just to boil it down in no uncertain terms, your message to those Chicagoans you heard from wearing their masks outside and waiting for Godot to say it's okay to take your mask off?
Yeah, so in my view, I mean, I've been skeptical about, any major impact from covering your face in the first place. But, given the vaccination, if you're vaccinated, it's almost impossible to make a logical and reasoned argument. CDC did a study. I mean, there was actually a controlled study on healthcare workers. It was a decent study where they tested people every week. They found 3 infections out of over 3,000 vaccinated healthcare workers who are coming in contact with people with COVID every day. I mean, and this was over a 3-month period. There's no argument that you can't make an argument for this. You cannot, I mean, to the idea of wearing them outside, you can't make a sane argument for it. I would say if you're vaccinated, obviously there's not any purpose to this. And if you're not vaccinated, and you choose not to get vaccinated, that's your choice. I mean, I don't really understand. I think as a public health crisis, this is over. I mean, it's not, we're done with it. It's not, we've got over 80% of the seniors have had at least one dose. You know, getting people over 65 and even 50 then vaccinated, and we're going to eliminate the hospitalizations and deaths in any serious way. I mean, not a whole lot of people are dying from COVID anymore. And I think we need to move on. I mean, look at Israel. They're done with it. They've had no deaths. I think they had just a handful of cases the other day. And I think they're the only people who get it are people who aren't vaccinated. If so my advice would be, if you're frightened, get vaccinated and then move on.
Yeah, but don't you think the government's pitting people like the vaccinated against the non-vaccinated against each other when they come out with new rules for certain groups of people who've gotten it? Or is they trying to encourage people who haven't been vaccinated to get vaccinated?
I don't, of course, and encourage are two different things. And I certainly encourage, I wouldn't coerce. And I think, that if you look at, this is an obvious thing when you look at the rates of vaccination. And if you look at it demographically by age, it's directly proportional to risk, other than the fact that the oldest maybe are slightly less than the more mobile elderly. 65 to 74 will have the highest rates of vaccination, as you might expect right now, because they're most able to get vaccinated. 90-year-old, it's not always that easy, but they're very close. And I think it tapers down as people get younger. I agree. I mean, I don't really, I think it's people's choice. If you don't get vaccinated right now, there's a reasonable chance you'll get infected. And if you're young and healthy, for sure, there's very little chance of having serious consequences from that. So it's really up to people. And yeah, I don't think they should be pitting people against one another. I don't think there should be criteria for taking part in activities. You know, I don't see a logical basis for it.
But Dr. Klein, there are studies out now that suggest that people can give COVID-19 to their cats.
Are you kidding me?
The Tampa Bay Zoo is moving to vaccinate their animals. Out of an abundance of caution, shouldn't we lock down until all the cats, the house cats, and all the zoo animals are vaccinated?
Yeah, so that probably. I think we definitely have to. If you look at mass psychology here, you know, it's really astounding that people have gone along with what's been done and are continuing to do so. And you can see other episodes in history where we've had you know, sort of these manias sweep, and people are just compliant without questioning. And I can't. You saw the piece. I wrote a piece in Daily Caller about this, and I really don't understand. I think that was one of the most. I write a lot, and that was one of the more important things, that, you know, pieces in my view that I've written. I don't understand this blind adherence to a few people who are in authority, who are telling people to do things without thinking, without questioning, and the idea that you can't ask questions or that you can't challenge
these
points of view that now are make no sense at all.
You know, part of this it is frightening. And part of this too is, you know, there's not been a proper amplification of the implications of the decisions we're making, the trade-offs that we're making. So for example, there was a release out from the Institute for Cancer Research in London, and Professor Paul Workman there said the following: the coronavirus pandemic has posed the greatest threat to cancer research in generations. They suggest that some cancer breakthroughs are now 2 years behind schedule. That's an implication.
Well, yeah, people were reluctant to see healthcare providers. They were reluctant to participate in clinical trials, which would help research. Our country slowed down in many ways, and unfortunately, we're seeing, I think, now some of the consequences of that. We'll see untreated disease. People have talked about this. It's not new. Especially if you listen to some of the, I guess, the news stations that try to present alternative opinions. But, you know, people have been concerned about the lack of adherence to general medical care. You've got a lot of elderly people, for example, who stopped exercising. That, you know, you have, you're elderly and you have heart disease, stop exercising. That's really that's very destructive. And really doesn't bode well from an illness standpoint. People didn't follow up on medical issues that they probably should have, including people with cancer who may now be treated at later stages. So we're going to see a lot of consequences from an overreaction to a serious situation.
He is Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, and former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. And I will tweet out that piece in Daily Caller he was referencing. Definitely worth a read and a share. Dr. Klein, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Their call for unity is a joke.
News.
Important question is not whether you're right or they're right, but why we shouldn't have the right to flip the channel.
Fuels. Opinion.
We have got to stop making it a crime to be a Republican.
News. Opinion. Insight. On AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we discussed the very sad diagnosis for Steve McMichael yesterday, that he has been diagnosed with ALS. And the Bears organization is helping. I saw Dan Hampton talking about it, and I guess some of the 85 Bears are helping too, yep, which is great. And I wonder, too, how much that diagnosis informed Andrew Shaw deciding to retire from hockey after his latest concussion per doctor's recommendation.
Yeah, had a 10-year career.
But I wanted to just point out something that was reported, too, in the interest of Steve McMichael. So they set up a GoFundMe account to help with medical bills. But he said there are some people that are selling stuff in his name that are not authorized. So they're essentially trying to profit off of what happened to McMichael with his diagnosis, that is. And so he said, the family said, the only authorized Team Mongo sellers are obviousshirts.com, obviousshirts.com, and teammongo76.com. So if you want to help, GoFundMe, the page the family set up, or obviousshirts.com, teammongo76.com. If you go someplace else, those are not authorized by the family.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. When you're moving out.
Before we get to our weekly installment with Ted Dabrowski, some sad news to report in Illinois, and that is that Marty Ozinga III, who is the chairman of the big Ozinga concrete concern, passed away unexpectedly. I got that message from my mutual friend, and Marty Ozinga was a great business guy, but he was a great guy, great human being, devout Christian, and ran for Congress, some may remember, against Debbie Halverson, and Illinois would have been a better place had he defeated Debbie Halverson back in the day. So just wanted to pass that along because it's an important Illinois and regional business and a great family, and he was a great guy. Got to know him a little bit over the years, and just a tremendous gentleman. So now Illinois is down to 17 congressional seats, and I say keep it up. Yeah. If we can get down to zero, then Illinois will have zero impact on the Electoral College. And that's, I think, a goal we all share.
Yes.
Ted Dabrowski is the president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So some encouraging news from the census. We lost another congressional seat, and, you know, the exodus is uninterrupted. It's only increasing in pace. And so, you know, if you want to see Illinois not play a role in presidential elections, then we're going in the right direction.
Well, yeah, you know, I think it's working like it should. If you have horrible policies, if you you know, keep bankrupting your state and keep stripping away freedoms, then people leave. And that means you deserve to have less representation in the country. I think it's working exactly like it should in a place like Florida and Texas, where they support more growth, more freedom. They support their businesses. You know, they're growing in representation. So it's working like it should.
Yeah, this is one form of redistribution I support because it's voluntary. So we're redistributing congressional seats away from New York and California and Michigan and Illinois and to Florida and Texas and North Carolina and Tennessee. That's the greatest market test, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think, you know, people are walking with their feet, voting with their feet, and they're telling, you know, the rest of America, this is what we want, or at least it shifts the power dynamics that way. And you know, as you mentioned, Texas picks up two seats. Florida picks up one. You know, Carolina picks up another. So it's, I think, in the right direction if you're looking for policies where you respect people, you respect businesses, and you don't want to grow your government to an incredible, crazy size.
So here in Illinois, since we're losing one congressional seat, do you think Governor Pritzker is going to honor his fair maps promise for redistricting?
No way. No way. You know, he made that promise a while back, but I think he's missing in action on that. I wouldn't expect any change there. So
they're moving to a June 30th map with supermajorities in both chambers. They're not going to have the commission for Democrats, for Republicans. And then if there's an impasse, you draw a name from Abraham Lincoln's hat to cast the deciding vote. They're not going to get there. They know better. This is always going to be a power play. So it's pay public homage to fair maps, and when you are in control, you vote your shares.
That's right. Hey, just one more point I want to make on the delegates.
Oh, yes.
They're going to paint this as good news, by the way, because the rumors were we were going to lose two two delegates. And so we only lost one. So this is actually good news, and thank goodness.
Well, that's it. That's just right. It's as expected. We lost one. Some doom and gloomers were talking about losing two. So everything's fine.
They spin
don't make a big deal about it. This is good. We're not as bad as you thought we were. That's some pitch.
Yeah, and I think what people need to remember, for those who aren't following, only three states lost population in the entire country, and Illinois was one of them. The other one was Michigan, which, of course, got destroyed by Detroit's bankruptcy and the flight that's gone on there. And the third one was West Virginia. So that's the crowd Illinois is with. And for those who continue to pursue a lot of these progressive tax hikes and things like that, it's not the right policies. I think people are telling us that.
So, Ted, I asked Dan this earlier. Who do you think is going to lose their congressional seat?
Well, that's a tough one. I don't know how they're going to do this. They're going to go after, I'm sure, Rodney Davis or Kinzinger, but I don't know how that's going to play out. Those politics are too big for me to figure that out.
Probably Mary Miller,
Miller.
Possible. So there's legislation kicking around Springfield that'll push more people out, so we don't lose our trajectory, and that is to strip local school districts and private schools of the ability to make their own decisions with respect to in-person versus remote versus hybrid if there's another pandemic or if they decide to extend this pandemic even long past its sell-by date.
Yeah, this is the big centralization that's going on in all government, right? Whether it's at the national level when they try to federalize a lot of things by doling out the trillions that they're handing out, at this level here in Illinois, let's strip all our boards, let's strip all of our private schools, let's strip everybody from decision-making and put it in a central source. And we've seen how bad that's been. I mean, if there's one lesson learned from COVID, is that the experts know nothing. And they've made so many mistakes. And I'm talking about all experts, right? They've all made mistakes. And so I think what you have to do is continue to leave decision-making as local as possible, closest to the source where people can make the decisions that are best for their community. But this putting more power in IDPH and COVID lockdowns that we've seen Pritzker manage, it's been, frankly for me, one of the biggest mistakes ever to allow a governor or anybody at the top to have this much power. Giving IDPH this much power to our kids is pretty much on target with that.
Yeah, because that means Dr. Nzeke is going to be in charge. And she's a lockdown enthusiast.
And what do we do, right? I mean, if one person decides that, there's nothing. If you go the other way and you let school districts open up or not, if everybody wants to stay closed, they can be, but it's local.
Right.
But giving one person that much power, it's wrong.
Another fun piece of legislation kicking around, this brought to us from State Senator Steve Stadelman, who is a former local news anchor. Senate Bill 134 creates a local journalism task force to study areas underserved by local journalism in Illinois and review strategies to improve local news access and public policy solutions to develop more sustainable business models for local media outlets. I think this is great. I think finally, and we're flush with that funny money from D.C., I think we should formalize the relationship between the Illinois Political Press Corps and the government and have the government fund the press corps. Let's just, strip away the pretense and just have the state government decide what the business model for news outlets is going to be and fund them directly. Wouldn't that be easier?
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier. I mean, it already works that way for the big ones, right? They toe the line on everything. So we just need it to be in the local level. So no, that's scary too. But when you have, again, that much money flowing, and we're going to get something like $25 billion from the federal government coming down to Illinois. They're going to have to work hard to spend that money. And it's a ton of money when you look at it on a per budget per year basis. So it will find its ways into things like that. And that's why they can run these crazy laws, because there might be money to fund it for a year or two.
Now, you and your colleague John Klingner wrote at wirepoints.org about some mayors not getting with the program, and maybe they need to be defunded if they're not going to be getting with the program at the state level. They're revolting against unfunded state mandates and the tax grab, the local tax grab by the state government.
Yeah, so Governor Pritzker wants to, keep working on his 2022 budget, and one of the ways he wants to fix it is to take $150 million that would go normally to cities, it's out of a bigger pool, and keep it for the state. And so It was good to see some mayors get together, a whole bunch of them, and they pushed back and they said, don't take our money. You know, the math doesn't work anymore. We spoke to Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering, and you know, she was willing to speak up and say, look, enough is enough. These unfunded mandates, you know, the pension mandates, the collective bargaining mandates, they really handcuff local government's hands to do anything on budgets. You know, everything's mandated by the state, and now Pritzker wants to take money away. It's destructive, and it, places like Danville, which we wrote about, places like that can't afford to lose money and be told what to do by the federal by the state government all the time.
That's sad when a good Democrat socialist like Nancy Rotering can't get along with her Democrat socialist at the state level. Gosh, my heart bleeds for Nancy Rotering.
At some point, the math doesn't work for her either, right? She needs to fund what's important to her, things that we may not agree with. But once that money's being taken away, she suddenly doesn't like it. And, you know, fortunately, in this case, she's speaking up about something that's wrong. But, you know, there's a lot more. There's a lot more that needs to be fixed. So,
Continuing to try to update sort of the one silver lining in this government maelstrom called Illinois. The Illinois Tax Credit Scholarship Program that has been targeted for effective elimination by Pritzker. Any update on where that currently sits and whether or not maybe some of these Democrat legislators that represent majority-minority districts are hearing from the beneficiaries of those, the families who are beneficiaries of that scholarship program, that tax credit scholarship program, in terms of better educational options for their kids. And that pushback is moving some people, or at least considering moving some people to consider whether or not they want to throw in with Pritzker.
Yeah, and I need to get a pulse of that. But I can tell you, there's a lot of people working it right now, and there's a lot of minority legislators who understand that a lot of their constituencies really like school choice. They like that they've gotten their kids this scholarship through the tax credit scholarship program. And have gotten out of the public school, so there's a lot there. So I think the good news is that there's a good group of legislators who understand this, and minority legislators. Now the question is, there's a lot of politics involved, and you know what wins over, I don't know. But you know, the power of these kids to be able to accept a scholarship and get out of the, you know, some of the CPS performance schools that are performing so poorly is huge. So I have to get my pulse on that movement there.
So we have a governor's election in 2022. We've got a few candidates who've already announced, a few Republicans, Darren Bailey, Gary Rabine, Paul Schimpf. And I'm wondering if you've heard any good policy ideas from them so far, or if not, we know what the policy agenda is for Pritzker. What are policies you'd like to see one or more of those Republican aspirants for the governor's mansion advance?
Well, you know, I always say, and it gets boring, right? We've been talking about this for years, but you can't fix Illinois without pension reform. And you know, I've heard them all speak and talk about the different issues. There was one talk up in somewhere in the northwest suburbs, and the three candidates were together, and they didn't mention the word pensions, and so. And I understand why, right? There's a lot of politics involved in that. But, you know, at this point, if you can't honestly mention pensions as a problem and run on pension reform, then, you know, you're just more of the same old, same old. I would say the good news is Darren Bailey has actually talked about pension reform, and he's talking about it the right way, I think. You know, he's talking about it's hurting everybody. Everybody's losing. And so, you know, he's actually leading on that effort, where I think the other two have yet to figure out. Well, I think Schimpf says he doesn't want to reform pensions, so I'm not sure how that qualifies him. But I think that's the leader. You can't fix the budget. You can't keep people in the state. You can't stop this population decline we talked about if you don't address the pensions, because they're destroying every city budget, every taxpayer wallet, and the core services people need.
Not to mention home values. Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ted. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, let's get a quick call in from the founder of the LGBT party, Love Guns, Bacon, and Trump. Mike on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I drew my own congressional remap. and it was published in the Lakefront paper, and my column about it was there. And the districts are compact and contiguous, and it puts Schakowsky and Quigley in the same district.
Oh.
And the northwest side gets its own district. It's not cannibalized. And a lot of people were interested in it, but I was told by two chiefs of staff, the state legislators, they were warned by the legal advisors in the General Assembly, you're not allowed to discuss redistricting with anybody. Now, why is it that they can't discuss issues with constituents? Because they're trying to put a muzzle on it. But if I can't take out these Democrats myself, I'll have them go at each other. All and right. I sent you a copy of the map, Amy. What did you think?
It's innovative. I don't think it's going to change anyone's mind. I think the maps are already drawn, and they're in Julie Stratton's office.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, we can't afford to lose either Quigley or Schakowsky.
Oh, I mean,
that'd be such
a great
loss.
Oh,
no, you can't do that.
We'd never be the same.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Bob Welch is an award-winning journalist and author. He previously collaborated with hero Don Malarkey on his best-selling memoir, Easy Company Soldier, The Legendary Battles of a Sergeant from World War II's Band of Brothers. And he's got a new book, Saving My Enemy, How Two World War II Soldiers Fought Against Each Other and Later Forged a Friendship That Saved Their Lives. It's a fascinating story we're checking out, and it involves the aforesaid Sergeant Don Malarkey and a German soldier, two World War II veterans. Bob Welch, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's an honor to be on the show. Thanks.
So tell us the story of an unlikely band of brothers.
Well, you know, Malarkey was a prominent in the HBO series Band of Brothers, and a hero, but he grew up with lots of PTSD. I remember he told me once, you know, at the end of the day, I'd have a drink, and at the bottom of my scotch, I could see the face of every man I left in Bastogne. And so while he in the United States is just grieving the war and being racked with pain, he killed a 16-year-old soldier once and said, I remember that kid every day. The same thing is happening to a guy named Fritz Engelbert in Germany, who is feeling terrible guilt for having served Hitler. And 60 years after the Battle of the Bulge begins, they wind up together in a pub in Germany. It's actually a gathering of U.S., current-day U.S. soldiers who are stationed in Germany to kind of encourage them. And there are six Band of Brothers there, including Malarkey. And Bill Maloney, this sergeant in the current day 101st Airborne, he decides to invite a couple of German soldiers, one of whom is this Fritz Engelbert. And Fritz is scared stiff. I mean, showing up to, in essence, be in the den of the enemy, and these enemy that have now become movie stars on, you know, HBO, he doesn't want to be there, and he's ready to leave when Malarkey hoists his beer into the air and says, welcome, Fritz Engelbert, to the Band of Brothers. And thus begins this friendship and a time of getting to know each other, of forgiving each other, and moving forward because of it.
That's just remarkable. So what were the initial conversations like? I mean, for example, what did Fritz, just to get his perspective, I mean, he, as you say, he regretted serving the Nazis, but what did he say about all that? How did it come to be that he did that, and what were his reflections afterward?
Well, Matthias, the son of Fritz Engelbert, is the translator in this little event. When they meet after the main event, the next night they sit down after spending the day together going through the cemeteries and Jack's Woods in Bastogne, where much of the Battle of the Bulge was fought. They sit down over a couple of beers, and both of them just sort of confess their brokenness, I guess. And Fritz says to, or Don says to Fritz, you know, it wasn't your fault, you had no choice. And right. he didn't. I mean, right. while Don Malarkey out here in Astoria, Oregon, is growing up like Huckleberry Finn, Fritz is in Hitler's youth. And Don says, you had no choice. And then later in the conversation, Don breaks down and confesses his remorse for killing so many Germans and how it's weighed on him all these years, trying to drink away the war. And Fritz says basically the same thing to him. It wasn't your fault. Your country called you. You did what you had to do. And that just releases, you know, 6 decades of shame and guilt with these guys. And they wind up meeting 2 more times. In the next few years. And in fact, their entire families meet in Belgium and they like each other. And now the son, the daughter of Don and the sons of Fritz are close friends. Marianne invited Matthias and Volker to Portland for a Band of Brothers reunion. And they're warmly accepted. So it's the rare war story, Dan, with a happy ending.
And, you know, I mean, from the perspective of Don Malarkey, I think it's pretty easy to understand, not the trauma he suffered, the guilt he felt, but he was in a kill or be killed situation. With respect to Fritz, you know, when I was reading about this, you know, it reminded me of Hannah Arendt's famous report, The Banality of Evil. Fritz was part of the Hitler Youth. So evil was normalized and at a young age. So it's not just that he was conscripted and he didn't have a Dietrich Bonhoeffer moment. He didn't have that opportunity because he was essentially brainwashed from a young boy to being a young man in Hitler's army.
Exactly. In fact, it's interesting you mentioned Bonhoeffer because he's the lead quote in the book is the will of God to which the law gives expression is that men should defeat the enemies by loving them. Now that in our day and age, that's a difficult thing. We've got a cold war of our own going on here in America, and regardless of our political ideology, at some point, I believe that there's got to be some sense of respect. There's got to be some sense of willingness to, in essence, like these guys, sit down over a couple of beers and at least find some sort of commonality where we can move a dialogue forward. That doesn't mean we have to agree with each other. That doesn't mean we have to necessarily even like each other. But at some point, we have to respect each other or be humble enough to begin anew. And I think that's the legacy that these guys have left us, that, hey, you know what? These guys served 5 miles apart in the Battle of the Bulge. Their goal was to literally kill each other. And 6 years later, they're best of friends. So it can happen.
So, Mr. Welsh, what will surprise readers about this book?
Well, I've written a handful of books about war, and they're about combat. They're about killing somebody that you know, the enemy, and this is about, in essence, loving your enemy and embracing your enemy and realizing, guess what, he during the war, he sent letters home to his mom too, and during the war Fritz prayed to his God too during the war, and suddenly you realize that as much as you try to make each other into the enemy, that you actually have things in common, and that is your humanity. So I think that's what would surprise people.
And what kind of life did Fritz Engelbart live when he came back to Germany after the war?
Interesting. He underwent an inner metamorphosis of great change. He basically became a Hitler hater in a country that was still pretty much excusing Hitler. And he went all the way over and became, in essence, a pacifist and just hated any mention of the word war. He would, on a Sunday afternoon gathering with the family, he would be the one who would break down and say, you know, it wasn't as glorious as you're making it sound. You know, they shot us like dogs. And so it was, he had a kind of a quiet brooding. He was a very successful businessman. He lost himself in his work, but he was not the touchy-feely dad, that's for sure. Whereas Malarkey, very conservative, very far to the right, And he expressed his remorse in the bottle, basically. He said as much in 2001 when A Band of Brothers was released. He said, you know, I tried to drink away the war. But what Saving My Enemy shows is that despite all that pain, despite that PTSD, you know, we can still find each other in the end.
Yeah, you know, I mean, watching that Band of Brothers series, which has been a while now, but I mean, you if you've watched it, what the first thing that jumps to mind, I think, is the interviews with those who actually served at the end of an episode where they talk about their experiences and they break down. I mean, it is tough stuff.
Yeah.
And I wonder how Fritz helped Don. You said he sort of looked for, he self-medicated with the bottle. And I wonder how Fritz helped Don. I mean, how Fritz helped Don in terms of their interactions with some of the demons that he was still wrestling with.
Yeah, I think what both men were looking for was affirmation and a sense that they, you know, it's like that end of Saving Private Ryan. Was I a good man? Mm-hmm. You know, did I live a good life? And I don't think that either of them deep down felt that. And I think what the forgiveness was able to do was affirm one another and say, you did live a good life, Fritz. You know, you raised two great sons. And you didn't do anything against your will. There was a moment in the book where, as a kid, at Hitler Youth, he wanted to turn in some Jewish neighbors. He didn't, but that his folks were actually helping give food to, and his conscience wouldn't let him do that, although he wanted to. And so Don was able to say, you know, you made the right choices, and so you know, don't. Keep throwing yourself under the bus. And Fritz basically saying the same thing to Don, but somehow coming from enemies, other people might have told them that, but coming from the enemy meant all the more. And because I think deep down, I think soldiers have respect for their enemy, even though they're trying to kill them. I think they respect them.
And as a writer, did writing about an American soldier and a German soldier challenge you in any way?
Definitely. Great question. It was, I mean, I knew Don Malarkey inside and out. I'd written Easy Company Soldier in 2008. I knew his story. Everybody in America who follows World War II knew Malarkey's story, but I didn't have a clue about this guy in Germany. And I told their sons, I said, you know, when I'm growing up, the Germans are a bunch of faceless guys who are the enemy. I never considered that you were like me, that you hurt, that you had moms and dads, that, you know, that you would write letters home. And so Fritz, the two sons of Fritz, Matthias and Volker, were huge helps. I think we traded 575 emails in 6 months. They were a huge help in trying to help me understand what it was like for their father growing up in Hitler Youth and how absolutely dedicated he was to Hitler and his vision for the world.
And I know Don Malarkey passed away a few years ago. What about Fritz?
Yeah, Fritz died in 15. Don died in 17. So, mm-hmm.
Well, this is a great story to tell, and you know, people to remember both, and this just remarkable bond between the two. It's an astounding story. Saving My Enemy is the book. How two World War soldiers fought against each other and later forged a friendship that saved their lives. Saving My Enemy. Bob Welch is the author. Bob, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Dan, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and, you know, there's that Senate Republican-driven audit of Maricopa County going on right now, the 2020 election. And I know it's being ridiculed by the left and it's being called dangerous and so on and so forth. But it's not just happening in Arizona. It's not just the voting reform law in Georgia. It's also being fought out in states, including North Carolina. And the lieutenant governor there, Mark Robinson, is quickly becoming my second favorite politician in America right now, which I know it's sort of like saying, what's your favorite virus? But right behind Ron DeSantis is Mark Robinson, lieutenant governor there. And he recently testified about the voter integrity message, legislation that North Carolina Republicans are pushing, testified before their state's Judiciary Committee, and had this to say.
And so as we sit here today, and as we're being accused by many of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle of wanting to somehow perpetuate the Jim Crow South, when in fact what we're trying to do is perpetuate laws that you can believe in that you've so eloquently discussed, do you see any merit in that whatsoever?
Absolutely not. And just can I, if I have a moment just to add something, you know, when you talk about that history is clear. Who stood on which side at every turn in history? It is clear. It's not even in dispute. And it's not in dispute now. What we want is integrity. We don't want power. We want integrity. We want the right thing to be done. We want to encourage citizens to be responsible. We want to have the best election system in the world. In the world. Third world countries, places like India where the poverty rate is staggering, they have to show that finger when they go vote. It's time that we modernize our election system in this country and stop playing all these silly games based on race. And please, stop using me as a black man as your pawn. And yes, I said it, to push your agenda. I'm sick of it. It happened a long time ago in this country, and I'm tired.
Chairman, I would.
Heart, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Which is the dumbest tax hike that Biden is set to propose? Ooh. A lot of competition for that.
What's your favorite?
Well, the Wall Street Journal opines on the dumbest being raising the capital gains, long-term capital gains, to as high as 43.4%. I'm inclined to agree with them. Among other things, it will actually reduce revenue to the federal government. The history of capital gains taxations bears this out. Selling an asset is usually a discretionary decision, so investors can decide when to realize a gain or loss. As rates rise, Americans tend to hold on to their assets longer, reducing realizations. The Congressional Budget Office has found that for each 1% increase in the capital gains rate, there is a 1.2% reduction in realizations. Raise the tax as much as Biden wants, and the realizations will fall significantly. The higher rate will cost the government revenue. So why raise a tax that would reduce investment and thus wage growth, innovation, and also reduce revenue for the government? Perhaps it's just punishment for its own sake. It's just straight ideology over sound economics. I don't know of another plausible explanation. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Alexander William Salter. He's an associate professor of economics at the Rawls College of Business at Texas Tech University, the Red Raiders. He's also a fellow at Texas Tech's Free Market Institute and author of Money and the Rule of Law, Generality and Predictability in Monetary Institutions, which comes out at the end of May. So, Amy, you'll look forward to that.
Thank you. I know it's going to be a beach read.
To add to your library of treatises from economics professors. Exactly. Professor Salter, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Do you concur with the Wall Street Journal Ed Board that the proposed capital gains tax hike is the dumbest that is set to be offered?
It was a pretty blunt assessment, wasn't it? Awesome. Bluntness aside, I think it's correct. We can discuss the merits of taxing various kinds of assets. Capital gains taxes really just don't make a whole lot of sense if your goal is to raise revenue. There are so many reasons why capital gains taxes aren't effective at actually generating resources for the federal government. That income is largely taxed twice. It doesn't take account of the rise in asset prices that are due to inflation. There are just a whole sort of economic mechanisms that make it such that Americans are just going to shift out of their assets and the tax base is just not going to be there. I wouldn't be surprised if this tax hike, if it actually makes it through, costs Uncle Sam revenue. At a time of soaring budget deficits, that's not something we can afford.
Well, you know, I mean, it's you got to sort of, I think, synthesize this in simple terms for a lot of people. And it's you tax something, you get less of it. You subsidize something, you get more of it. So if you tax investment, which is what a capital gains tax is, you're going to get less investment. So raise your hand. You want less investment in the economy? You want people saving less? That doesn't seem to be consistent with how most people live their lives or the perspective they have on opportunity and growth.
That's precisely it. When you have more investment, you have more purchases of capital equipment, other things that make workers more productive. So over the moderate to long run, all those investments in corporate productivity really result in increases in employee wages. So when you tax investment, what you're really doing is taking money out of employees' pockets in the long run. This is something that's a little bit counterintuitive, but we really need to do a good job of emphasizing the economic logic. Everybody thinks that whoever you place the legal burden of a tax on, that necessarily also means it's the economic burden. It's not true. You can't tax investment, you can't tax corporations without also taxing employees and customers. It just can't be done.
Well, that's the point here too, right? That's why I suggest this is ideological for its own sake, regardless of impact, because is, you know, capital gains, it's a way to say it's fat cats, it's a way to say the long-term capital gains tax is a loophole, you know, for rich people, and you talk about millionaires and billionaires and their passive investment income and so on and so forth. So it's a way to try to essentially gaslight people that don't have huge investment portfolios, but probably would like them at some point in their working lives, try to gaslight them into saying, you know, we're just making the rich pay their fair share.
There's a lot of that talk. I think digging into it, there might be two reasons behind this proposed tax hike. One of them is just simple coalition building. As you said, it's a signal to the extreme left wing of the Democratic Party that Biden is their guy and is going to continue being their guy. And, of course, it could just be an initial offer of something that obviously nobody wants with the hopes of bargaining down to something different later on. But in terms of the economics of the package, which is what my comparative advantage at analyzing this thing is, it just doesn't make sense. So I'll leave the politics to people who know more about that than I do. But I do think it's important for us economists to warn, look, if this thing happens, you're going to see the effects in foregone economic growth, foregone employee wages. It's not going to be the fat cats who are hurt the most over the moderate to the long run. It's going to be Main Street.
Well, let's move over to the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, because I'm old enough to remember a time when, you know, President Obama promised smart green projects and we got that Solyndra debacle.
That's right. So we have another round of that going on now with the Biden administration. If you look at what's actually in this infrastructure bill, there's a couple hundred billion for roads and bridges, but there's frankly a lot more for long-term care for the elderly and also electric vehicles, supporting systems for electric vehicles. Without talking about whether these are valuable things or not, that's a debate that we should actually have in Congress where the people's representatives can weigh in. It's clear that this bill is not what most Americans understand by infrastructure. It's just another omnibus bill with pork thrown into it to try and placate Democratic Party special interests. And frankly, we can't afford it.
In your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, I was tickled by your quote from Nobel laureate Joe Stiglitz, a Keynesian. Fiscal policy is back, the $2.3 trillion infrastructure newly defined. We'll create more demand, and that should give people more confidence to invest. Fiscal policy is back. Has Professor Stiglitz noted the $8 trillion in funny money over the last 12 months?
$8 trillion in funny money. I assume that you're referring to Federal Reserve activity.
Yes.
So that's a little bit different in terms of what side of the ledger that falls on.
No, I know. But my point is to say he's focused. Oh, fiscal policy is back. I mean, the monetary policy has come over the top of any fiscal solutions in quotation marks that have been offered.
Oh, absolutely. And what's really interesting about this is at least since the COVID pandemic really hit in March of 2020, what the Fed has been doing is fiscal policy, but financed by the printing press. Right? So what they've been doing is direct credit allocation, making direct loans to corporations that have nothing to do with the health of the financial system. Right? Over the course of the pandemic, the Federal Reserve created new liquidity and used it to do things like loan money to Coca-Cola or Berkshire Hathaway. I might have missed something in my graduate economics courses, but I'm pretty sure the integrity of the soda industry isn't really necessary for financial stability. So this is really just getting outside of the wheelhouse here.
You know, I just sticking on this, the melding of monetary and fiscal, as you were describing. So, you know, we were talking about this pre-pandemic. How do we unwind from a decade of quantitative easing, you know, modern monetary theory? And now we've just thrown another $8 trillion onto the pyre. I don't know that anybody knows how that unwinds, but combine that with some of these confiscatory taxes that are being proposed, I mean, what's your projection of the impact that would have over the, you know, the near to medium term as we try to unwind from all of these policies that run afoul of all of those economic courses you took and teach?
I think the worst case scenario is a return of what we call stagflation, simultaneous high inflation and economic sclerosis in the form of falling real production and employment. So if you have massive stimuluses on the demand side from both the fiscal and the monetary authorities, but at the same time you have more regulation, you have more taxes, which do a great job at choking off growth, that's going to hurt the supply side. So the net result of that is going to be more price increases, inflation, and less economic productivity. And that's going to show up in, of course, reduced jobs. That's the worst case scenario. I think a lot of this hinges on whether the Federal Reserve can muster the political will or not to actually try and unwind their balance sheet a little bit, maybe raise the interest rate that they pay on excess reserves. We have this myth that the Federal Reserve is politically independent. In truth, the Fed is one of the least politically independent central banks in the world. For good or ill, political pressures are a reality at the Fed, and it'll be interesting and not a little bit frightening to see how Jerome Powell's Fed resists the inevitable pressure coming from the Biden administration.
So then the best case scenario you're suggesting is sort of an incremental walk back, a journey of 1,000 miles, perhaps, a little bit at a time to minimize the damage, to dull the knife just a little bit and extend that unwinding over the course of a decade or more?
Perhaps that long. I think the best case scenario is moderate, if hardly earth-shattering, economic progress combined with inflation running in the 2% to 2.5% territory per year. Now, a lot of people are pointing out what's going on right now in the economy as the Biden boom, because the economy is really picking up. But the truth is the economy was really going to pick up anyway as more people got vaccinated, as private and public authorities lessened business restrictions. A lot of the economic improvements that we're seeing right now would have happened no matter who won in November. And so I think that it's important that we don't allow the Biden administration to do a victory lap and take credit for economic gains that almost certainly would have happened right now anyway. Biden's test is going to be in the next 1 to 2 years, where I think the most likely scenario is, frankly, unimpressive economic growth. But I think it's possible that we get moderate economic growth in the amount of 2 to 3% per year. I don't think that's outside of the realm of possibility.
So sort of the slow growth recovery we experienced in the Obama years after the 2008-2009 recession.
Right, similar to that, although I would expect inflation to run a little bit higher just because of all the things that are going on the demand side of the economy.
He is Alexander William Salter, Associate Professor of Economics at Rawls College of Business at Texas Tech University, fellow at the Texas Tech Free Market Institute, and author of Money and the Rule of Law, Generality and Predictability in Monetary Institutions, which releases at the end of May. Professor Salter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Amy, you know how I know we're living in strange times?
How?
Because Caitlyn Jenner is being referred to as a conservative firebrand. The last we checked in with Caitlyn Jenner, she was making a big show of, or he was using a making a big show of using the women's room at Trump Tower.
Right. That's right. Right.
Now he's running for governor.
You have to use the right pronoun. Is she running for governor or is he running for governor?
For me, it's he.
Okay, but others, it'll be she.
Well, obviously, but yeah. I'm into biology, but others are not. I got that.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a Babylon Bee story as well. Babylon Bee, the paper of record for
Which
our times.
Like The Onion.
Gavin Newsom is now identifying as a woman, doesn't want to be outdone by Caitlyn Jenner. He's Gabby Newsom, and his preferred pronouns are brave and amazing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because he's looking for recall in the fall because they've got the petitions, the signatures have been verified, and it's game on.
Caitlyn Jenner, in announcing his gubernatorial bid. For the past decade, we have seen the glimmer of the Golden State reduced by one-party rule that places politics over progress and special interests over people. I'm a proven winner and the only outsider who can put an end to Gavin Newsom's disastrous time as governor. And Jenner talks specifically about the lockdowns, anti-lockdowner.
Good.
So I guess in California, Caitlyn Jenner is as good as you're going to do.
But the left, they're going to have a hard time. I mean, you know, she's, what are they going to say about her? They celebrate people like that.
Although I guess the, and not that I follow this stuff, and I'm ashamed to have to make the following statement.
What?
I guess the Kardashians are not on board with their dad?
No, that's their dad. Really?
Yeah.
I thought that they'd be supporting him.
Women can be dads now, too. Men can be pregnant and women can be dads.
Yes.
Got it. All right. That clears it up. Thank you.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.